Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice, an independent streaming internet radio station, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. Folks, this broadcast is being brought to you live on Thursday morning, December 11, 2008. It's now about 6:31 a.m. Central Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good morning, everyone. Today is a very special morning. We have a special guest calling in. It's an American who's living currently in England. But before we do that, I'd like to encourage everyone. I'm inviting everyone to call worldwide now. I know we're in the United States, but if you're in Europe, in England, or wherever you are, or even in the Far East, to call 646-652-4620. I'll call in number this morning, and we will have an hour program this morning, 646-652-4620, or you can email us at any time to comments@libertytalkradio.com. That's comments@libertytalkradio.com. I encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, mytwocentsonline.com. And I think our caller is on the air as we speak.
Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, if you can speak up just a bit, please.
Okay, I'll try.
That's fine. Now, Jeffrey, before I embarrass myself, which I do constantly, could you please help me with the proper pronunciation of your last name?
Yeah, my name is Jeffrey Schlamman.
Schlamman.
You still probably can't pronounce it, so just Jeff or Jeffrey is fine.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. I would have gotten that a little wrong. I was really close, but all right. Do you mind if I call you Jeff?
That's perfect.
Okay, that's great. All right. Because I'm afraid my mind will skip. I'd like to also alert you of something. I am fighting a severe throat infection, and from time to time, I lose my voice. In the event that all of a sudden I sound very raspy, it is not your telephone. Most likely, it's my voice giving way. So I hope it'll stay with me for this hour, okay? Well, thank you so much for calling in. It's a real pleasure. It's kind of exciting when we have people calling in from the other side of the pond, so to speak. I did not have an opportunity yet to give an introduction. So let me do this. Since you know more about yourself than I do, why don't you give yourself an introduction, and it can be as detailed as you would like.
Okay. My name is Jeff Schlamman. I'm currently a financial executive living in England. I'm a California CPA, a former auditor, over a decade in finance. The Subprime Factor was the first book I've written. I'm looking forward to discussing it all with you today. And if you have any questions, I hope you ask.
Okay, that's great. Well, Jeff, it's kind of interesting because when I read your bio, I did not have an opportunity to read your book. I was given an opportunity to take your book. Your publicist, Phoenix, was going to send me a book, and I said, "Let me be honest with you. Right now, I'm 14 books behind, and I'm swamped." So I do apologize for that. It is not for lack of interest. Let me tell you, I have been following this for over 10 years myself, very, very closely, and probably as you have experienced, most people thought I was nuts for the past 10 years because everything was just fine. But what I find fascinating is the fact that you're a financial person, and yet you would have expected that someone would write a factual sort of a chronological sequence of what has occurred, and then may give some projections, you know, be sort of like a wizard and tell us where we are. But you decided to write a novel, and I thought that was so interesting. Why a novel and not a nonfiction book?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, a novel, I think, is going to reach more people that normally wouldn't be interested in the subject. There's so much going on. There's so much noise out there, especially from professionals, a lot of them that got us into this mess, that, it just seems like the way to reach the public, the population, the people that aren't interested particularly in, you know, in world finance. And that's why I chose a novel. And hopefully I do get to reach a number of people.
Well, I hope so, too. And I hope this program helps you get on that New York Times bestseller book, okay? And we will try to promote you any way that we can. Now, another question is writing a novel, writing a book. People have asked me to write a book for years, and I've declined, respectfully declined, because I don't think I'm qualified, number one. But secondly, the commitment is phenomenal, just like having a radio program is a phenomenal commitment. How did you decide to finally sit down and put, you know, pen to paper to accomplish this, I think, a Herculean project?
Well, like you, Joe, and you did it through radio. I mean, it was something I became passionate about, and it was early in 2006. The housing bubble had maybe just begun to pop, and the news all over our mainstream media was everything's fine. You know, the stock market that summer in August hit its all-time high. The Dow hit over 14,000, and I'd been, like you, for years talking about how this wasn't sustainable. How, you know, this isn't real. What's happening? It isn't real. It's a expansion via debt, And I started writing the book, hoping it would be done in time that it could warn people about the collapse that's happening. Fortunately or unfortunately for me, the book came out the same day as the first bailout bill was voted on. And one of the themes of the book was that the government had this conspiracy to pass all of the bad debt of the banks onto the public. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out to be a conspiracy, but fortunately, it did validate the theme of my book. But being passionate about it is the reason is what gets you to write it. You know, needing to get the message to people. And in writing a book, I had so much help. You know, editors and friends. And this isn't just me scribbling on a notepad and getting the thing out there. I mean, there were probably dozens of people that helped me in one way or another.
Now, what is your opinion of those people on, for example, the broadest reach that we have here in the States is CNBC News regarding the financial situation? I find them to be overly optimistic and a little resident to discuss the real issues. Is it just my pea brain, you know, dumb talk show host mind that says that, or is there some truth to that?
I don't know, Joe. I mean, I think it's going to be a combination of two. I mean, obviously there is interest in Wall Street and you know, anybody in a publicly traded company in particular to keep this bubble going. But also, our education system, our business institutions, they teach things wrong. They teach, I mean, almost every financial system we have set up says, well, equities are going to go up over the long term at some massive amount over you know, GDP growth or whatever a normal economy could grow, and everything's going to be hunky-dory, and they teach everybody in an MBA the way to maximize returns is through leverage. And I think that a lot of people, I mean, unless, with the exception of a few of us, or maybe people that have studied history, they really don't know. They really don't know. And if you do try to look for the credible sources, you know, the mainstream sources, you're going to learn the same thing. You're going to hear the same thing.
Well, you
everything's going to fix itself, and it's somehow we can all become millionaires by investing in it. stock market or by buying houses or whatever the gimmick of the day is.
Yeah, I've always had to work very hard, you know, and I had my own business. It almost failed twice. Worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I realized how silly I was when all I had to do is repackage paper, and I could have become a millionaire.
and that probably is true.
You know,
it works in certain times.
That's right. Well, you know, I guess I'm always a little bit late on that. All right, now why don't you tell us about your book in other words, the thread that permeates your book and the overall, you know, the overall focus of your book and how it plays out.
Okay. Well, it's a financial thriller. It tells the story of four friends, an accountant, an FBI agent, a slick real estate broker, and kind of a guy like you, maybe a little bit of a, he's described as a conspiracy theorist, but he's more on to the reality of the situation. The auditor stumbles upon a conspiracy between the government and the banks to pass all the bad debts that the banks had acquired onto the taxpayer via the treasury, there's all the normal stuff you'd expect in a thriller, the hitman and then things like that. The main points, I mean, getting around the story, which I hope everybody enjoys, and I think it's a good story, is I want people to understand, one, how money is created, and how creating money applies to us every day, and that, you know, creating money is inflation, and inflation really is a regressive tax. It's a tax,
right,
on the public, and it affects people that consume, so it's not gonna hit your top echelons of society, of earning society. What fractional reserve banking is, and just describe some of the ins and outs of the financial system, how the bubble went in place. You know, talk about how the loans were repackaged and resold, really, you know, just to talk, you know, let's talk about how financial advisors and real estate agents and all these paid professionals can give bad advice when their own paycheck is on the line.
Okay, now I have a question for you. I understand what happened. I understand the mechanics. I don't understand why it happened. For example, if a bank repackaged a bunch of loans, why would someone buy it who was financially astute, pay top dollar for it, basically, in hopes that this is any good without ever knowing it? In other words, could you walk us through how does this really happen? Walk us through the nitty-gritty in Dick and Jane language so our radio audience could understand.
Okay, well the basic subprime loans are, everybody probably knows that. It's the option arms, it's the non-qualified buyers.
Right.
And it's bad paper. People know it, and they're not going to pay full price for these loans.
Right.
So what happened is these loans got packaged up with the prime, with the good loans, you know, the somebody that put a big down payment on a house and has a stable income, and what they did is they give, maybe, you know, 5% of it is going to be the garbage loans. 95% of it's going to be what they call good loans. You know, some of it's alt A, which is sort of the in between, and then it went to the ratings agencies, which you may have heard of as Fitch, Moody's, S&P, who stamp these things based on whatever model they've set up and whatever the chances of these things defaulting are. So two things happened. One was the ratings agency underestimated the losses of these things. And two, they were bought with huge leverage. So if S&P had said that this set of mortgages is going to have a 1% default, and actually it had a 5% default, so only 1 in 20 went bad.
Right.
That makes a big difference, because when these things were sold off, people were borrowing money at a rate of 20 to 1 to buy them. So what that means is if you put 5%, it's like buying a house with a 5% down payment. You make a 5% down payment to buy these,
right,
you know, collateralized debt obligations.
Right.
And the thing, and 5% of the thing's garbage, well, you've just wiped out all of your money.
Okay.
You've wiped out that entire investment.
Right.
And
okay,
that's how the whole tumble began.
Yeah. Now, Why have
did that make sense at all?
Why haven't we seen the demise of Moody's and Standard & Poor's?
That is a very good question. A very, very good question. I mean, even today. I mean, well, everybody's familiar with Lehman Brothers and yes. what happened with their paper. Their paper was rated high quality up to the day that they disappeared. They went bankrupt. So I don't know what the future of those ratings agencies is going to be. And if for all practical purposes, people are not going to be able to rely on their ratings at that point. You know, what's the point of having them exist? It's shocking.
Well, just take a second for station identification, folks. This is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We have with us today as our guest, and we are honored to have as our guest someone from England, calling from England. And Jeffrey, I'm going to mispronounce your name. Jeffrey Schlamman.
Schlamman.
There
you
go. I got to say, all right. Jeffrey Schlamman, he's the author of Subprime Factor. He's a financial executive, and it talks about our financial debacle that we're going through now. Please join us. Our call-in number is 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. I know there are a lot of sleepyheads here in the States, but we do have plenty of listeners in the European continent, so please give us a call, 646-652-4620. No question is too silly. We welcome your call. Thank you. Okay, now, where do you think the subprime situation will lead us? And will it be the subprime loan, or will it be these credit default swaps? And then my follow-up question is, why the heck are we bailing them out in the first place if this is all funny paper that should never have been written in the first place? Why am I paying for this?
Again, an excellent question. A very good question. The reason for the bailout is, I believe, that our government feels like they need to be doing something right now. I mean, the bubble was created, and it's collapsing. There's nothing. I don't believe there's anything they can do about it. But you can imagine what the public would think if Congress and George Bush and Barack Obama just said, "Hey, nothing we can do." So what they're doing is they're taking these drastic measures, and I think there's definitely some preference in who's getting bailed out. I mean, there's, you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can help me with.
Paulson is from Wall Street. He's from Goldman Sachs, and it seemed to me, if I were to speculate, that most of the bailout has been with financial institutions.
Right. Well, why couldn't they take these collateralized debt obligations and extract all the bad loans? Keep all the good ones in there, repackage it as a new collateralized debt obligation that, in fact, is a AAA, prime mortgage type obligation, and take them out and say, okay, now, here are all the bad loans. They equate to $2 billion or $40 billion, whatever the case may be, and put them aside. Why haven't they been able to do that? Why do they have to stay commingled with good mortgages?
Well, one of the problems and one of the things that created it was the security on these things. Houses was seen to be so good at the time. When the money markets, froze up and people would no longer buy these collateralized debt obligations, that sort of tipped off the housing crash. And at this point, from where we were when subprime first broke, and I want to say it was, I might be wrong here, but it was around January, February 2007 when the first sort of subprime lenders started going under. To today, I mean, house prices have absolutely collapsed, and now right. We don't have the small 5% that would have been rated bad. In fact, what you've got is you've probably got 40-50% that are bad, somewhere along those lines.
Okay.
And the papers, it's garbage. And you're seeing the banks being forced to buy back some of this garbage, and then the banks are getting bailed out by the government, and that's it. I mean, the mortgages still exist. People are still obligated to pay, but either they're not or the risk is that they won't in the future.
Well, what we're saying is that the subprime mortgage debacle helped create the deflation of housing prices, which then lessened the ratings of even good mortgages, because even the good mortgages now were underwater.
Correct.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, is it really the subprime debacle that is bringing us to our knees, financial knees, basically, or is it the collateralized debt obligations, which are just bets that these things will be paid off?
It's a bigger picture than that. Those were sort of the tools used to create the thing, but the whole thing has been leverage. And, I mean, it was leverage in housing. The businesses have leveraged themselves as far as they can in order to maximize their returns. The consumers have leveraged themselves with credit cards. Debt has expanded so far, and it's created this bubble that's going to go away. I mean, I don't know what the lessons you learned in high school, but I remember, you know, sitting there in economics or history class, and they said the reason the Great Depression was created was people were buying stocks, you know, with 10% margin.
That's correct.
A little 10% drop in the stocks, it created, you know, as soon as the stock dropped 10%, people were wiped out, had to sell, driving the prices lower. We think about how that's happened today, and you can start with the houses where in many cases people were borrowing hundreds of thousands of dollars with no money down or even getting money back to buy a house.
Yeah.
From that spot down, you know, and how that trickles down to, okay, businesses were doing very well because there was this money created. Businesses leveraged themselves. They borrowed as much as they could based on financial plans that showed the economy growing forever. And when all this loses its steam, people can't pay back this debt, and the debt collapses. And that's why I think it is important for people to understand how money's created. It's created by the banks. It's created by lending. And how a fractional reserve banking system like we have today will always create booms and busts.
Now, so we're saying that these collateralized debt obligations really aren't just 5% bad anymore. They're much worse than that, and they really aren't any good. I mean, from an overall point of view, I mean, from a package point of view, they're not worth near what they should be worth.
Right, that's right.
All right. Now, are you familiar with Ron Paul, the congressman from Texas?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, okay. He has been calling for the end of the Federal Reserve. And he feels, as many other institutions, including, and I'll quote the American Institute of Economic Research, which I have the utmost respect for, you know, saying that the very crux of our problem is the fractional reserve system, the Federal Reserve, and the way we actually create our money. That should be the pillar, and if the pillar is made out of sand, and you can't build on that. Could you comment on that, please?
I can comment and say that he's exactly right, and I mean it's sad that, you know, I mean, up until really recently, where I think Congressman Paul is getting a lot more respect and a lot more people following, he's always kind of the wacko, you know, he's that guy, you know, talking about that crazy stuff. But he is absolutely right. I mean, it really can't be denied. And the Federal Reserve Bank, you know, people say, well, we're this system of capitalism, and it's capitalism let us down. It's lack of regulation. But the Federal Reserve Bank is basically a government institution. It's the government determining the credit, and really, that is the socialist or communist part of our system, and that's what created this mess. Because if this was private people that own these banks, and these banks, if they fell, they weren't going to get bailed out, and they didn't have special deals with the government, the banks never would have loaned money. Who's going to loan money to, you know, some guy that hasn't had a job in 5 years and didn't have a down payment for a house? Who's going to loan him on a 100% loan?
Right. I remember when I applied for a loan, I was working for a fully integrated oil company for many years. I was a family man, incredibly stable, you know, no prospects of losing my job. The oil business was doing well. I bought a very modest house. It was 40. This is 30 some odd years ago. It was $45,000. I put $20,000 or $25,000 down, and it took about 10 days for me to get approved for a mortgage.
Yeah.
And the mortgage rate was 8.75%. Now, and when I think back at those days compared to today, I go, you know, something is wrong somewhere. Someone's wrong. You know, as I say, something's wrong in Denmark. My son just purchased a house in Denver 940 square feet, which obviously is a small house, him and his wife, for $356,000. Now, he has an excellent job. He's a chemical engineer, and she works for the EPA, and they make plenty of money. But just the thought of having a mortgage that's one-third of $1 million, that's the way I look at it, you know, and he was only able to put down 5%, which I could not understand. I thought he'd be able to pay cash for it, because that's the way I am. And as a result, he has to pay $150 a month in insurance, default insurance, because he only put 5% down. And I guess that's one of the more stable situations. I could imagine if he did that. I guess the mentality is so different today by people, where in my days, I mean, no one would have thought of doing that. You know, you saved your money, you bought a house according to how much money you were making, you know, et cetera. You always bought less than you could buy, you know, the whole bit. And today it's the exact opposite. And him, God forbid, he loses his job. I mean, I don't know how you handle a mortgage that size.
Absolutely, and as we can clearly see now, people can't. I mean, people cannot afford mortgages like that, and the money never should have been lent. And anybody looking at it objectively would have said the same thing.
Yeah. And he pays this $150 a month, Jeff, and I said, well, geez, I said, isn't that, I don't criticize. I never criticize myself. I said, you do what you want to do. You know, I said, you can come to me for advice. I'd be more than happy to give you the benefit of my, you know, my experience, and I could be wrong. And I never criticized, but I said, well, you're going to pay this $150 for the rest of your life or what? How does that work? He says, no, when the value of the house goes up so many percent, 20% or something like that, then they drop it. And I go, well, what if the housing doesn't go up? He says, oh, housing in this area always goes up. And I thought to myself, isn't that exactly what we're talking about? You know, things are always going to go up. Things are always going to get better. No one ever sits down and says, what if, you know, the what if question. What if, my voice is going, by the way, what if things don't go up? We don't do that anymore. When I was young, it was always, we had more what ifs than anything else. In fact, it's surprising we ever did anything. But as a result, we never went bankrupt.
I understand exactly what you're saying, and it's not just people, it's not just your son, and it's not just, you know, Joe Schmo on the street and me and you. It's the institutions we've created. I mean, you look at these pension funds and the ways that they're valued is, you come up with your pension, your asset values, and your liabilities, and your deficits based on these percent returns that are going to happen. So these, whether a pension fund is over or undervalued depends on how they say the assets are going to do. Well, of course, what's going to do the best? Equities. They're going to return 9% a year forever, and you know, or 6% over inflation. And if you think about just how silly that is, I mean, that just, it doesn't make sense, does it? How can you have this much more money being created and have inflation stay the same?
Right.
I mean, something will change in the system. Something will have to.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about the future in our next 25 minutes. Just hold on 1 second for station identification. Once again, this is Joe Cristiano. You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. We are honored to have as our guest Jeffy Schlamman. Did I say that correctly? Schlamman?
You did. Yeah,
right. I'm getting smart in my old age. Jeffy Schlamman, he's the author of Subprime Factor, a book about this subprime debacle we're going through. Our call-in number is 646-652-4620. 646-652-4620. Come on, folks. We have plenty of open lines. I know it's early in the morning here in the central zone in the United States, but in Europe, there are plenty of people up and about. Get on the telephone and give us a call, 646-652-4620 in the good old USA. We'd love to hear your, field your calls. All right, now, we know basically, for my benefit, Jeff, would you explain to our listening audience as well as to me what is a tranche? When they talk about tranches.
A debt tranche, is that what you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah, a tranche is just different levels of debt, they take different priority in the repayment and risk, and so they have higher or lower interest rates associated with them. If you're in the best or the highest tranche of debt, the most secure, the one that would get paid off first in a default, then you'll get the lowest interest rate. In the worst tranche, we'll have a higher interest rate and we'll be the most at risk, basically.
Yeah. Now, when they say that they disembody these things and they put in these collateralized debt obligations, they don't take apart the mortgage itself. They just put different tranches all together in the same package rather than having a CDO tranche 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 type thing. Is that correct?
Yeah. They package bad debt with good debt in order to make the thing, in order to get it the rating that it needed to be sold.
Is that
what you're asking?
Yeah, they put the good with the bad, basically, when they should put all the AAA in one tranche, basically, right? That should be one category. And then they should have another collateralized debt obligation, say, hey, these are BBBs, on this group, so that people could evaluate them accordingly. And that's what they did not do. And they didn't do it because they knew that the rating agencies, which are controlled by the issuers anyway, are going to give them a good rating. And then if it defaulted, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were going to buy it, and they're backed by the government, so the government was going to pay for it anyway. Am I correct in assuming that?
You are basically correct, yeah. I mean, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they get the bulk of the ones that were not subprime, but the ones that were termed conventional. But sure, you're absolutely right.
Did Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buy many of these collateralized debt obligations or these mortgages that, people knew were no good, but they repackaged them anyway and then eventually they were sold to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, or did they go someplace else?
I'm not sure that they bought them, but I'm not an expert on the subject. I understand that they back them, so they're backing some of the mortgages, and so if they're winding up being defaulted on, well, Fannie and Freddie have to pay back on them, and they probably are stuck with tons of mortgages. They have their own CDO, or in effect. That's my understanding, and I may have that wrong.
All right, now regarding collateralized debt obligations, why the heck did anyone do that? I mean, why would any company extend a insurance basically on someone else's debt, basically a bet that it would not go bad, I know they make money on the deal, and
are you talking about credit default swaps?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, why? Like AIG was filled with those things, and that's what I understand. What actually took them down?
Yeah, it's gambling, isn't it? that's what it is. It's the name of the game on Wall Street, though. It's like you said early in the show, make millions of dollars shuffling paper and repackaging it and selling financial instruments. It's just like selling insurance if the insurer has no assets.
Right.
How much is that insurance worth? Well, somebody's probably paying for it.
I'm sorry. I walked over your words. Please continue.
No, I was done.
All right. Well,
that's all I had to say, Joe.
Is it so that we, human nature, that we extend tomorrow what we experience today? Like, if today is a good day, all of a sudden everything from now on is going to be okay. Conversely, if things are bad today, everything from now on is going to be bad. Do we extend that? And is this what happened to Wall Street and to the financial markets, where they said, well, this has never gone bust. We've been playing this game for a long time. We know this is Russian roulette. But hell, since it never happened, good times are here to come anyway. Is that a mentality that took over Wall Street?
It sure seems that way to me. It sure seems that way to me. Yeah, I mean, and our institutions reinforced that, up to the point where you had the Federal Reserve, decreasing their interest rates, meaning they wanted to continue to lend more and more and more money and advance the money supply, even when everything was growing and booming. I mean, things didn't make sense, and it must be like that.
Yeah.
And hopefully people don't get too pessimistic, when things fully hit. It will turn around, but when is the question?
All right. If you had to play Grand Wizard and you're going to project what's going to happen. You know, what do you think would have happened if we decided not to bail out these companies? What would have happened?
Well, I think you have to look at the individual companies. And the main thing is, if you take, let's say we have a company that they've got stock and all they do is they bought these CDOs, they bought these mortgages. Well, things are going bad. They don't have the cash. You know, the company is going to go bankrupt. So what would happen in case of that bankruptcy? Well, whoever funded the company, all the stockholders, all the debt holders, they would get wiped out.
Right.
All of those mortgages or all those CDOs are still there. They just get resold off somewhere to what they're worth. The problem and why I think the bailout's happening is, well, what happens when a stock price goes from $100 to $0 and it happens all across the world, and what happens to the pension funds and what happens to the jobs and how that spiral goes down. But in reality, I mean, you have to wash out the bad companies, and you have to wash out the bad decisions, and you have to wash out the bad debt. And it will happen. It absolutely will happen, and it, you know, it, you can't stop it. You can't stop. You can't keep a bad company alive. You know, with more money, it's going to continue to be a bad company. It's going to just continue to lose that money.
Well, a friend of mine is a retired fire marshal, and he is concerned about his pension. There's a few hundred thousand dollars in it, and he's thinking about withdrawing that money because he feels that there's going to be some sort of financial collapse. He's very pessimistic. I shouldn't say pessimistic. He's just very concerned, and he's afraid that he's going to wind up losing that pension that he worked so long and hard for. And being a firefighter and a fire marshal is not an easy job. I would not want that job myself, and it's well earned. And he's really afraid of that somehow losing its value or losing it altogether, and he's thinking about withdrawing it and putting into something solid like some silver, gold coins or something like that. What kind of advice would you have for someone like him?
Wow, I mean, I guess his pension then is not a defined benefit where it's guaranteed by a state or local government where he's guaranteed a monthly payment.
Well, he is a state employee. He's a city employee or county employee, I guess. He's municipal, so it's guaranteed.
I mean, it's a hard question. I mean, the financial advice I give my friends right now is put everything into cash, and when I say cash, I mean federally insured CDs, or if you have that much cash, which I don't know very many people that have over couple hundred thousand dollars, buy treasuries. And I mean, it's unfortunate because what you're actually seeing now is treasuries are returning pretty close to 0% return.
Well, it's become an actually negative return, hasn't it?
It did dip into negative, yeah, for a little while. I'm not sure what it's at today.
Yeah, well,
but that tells you that's the real market speculating on what's going to happen, and it's saying losing. Okay, if we say it's negative, well, losing 1% a year, that's a heck of a lot better than leaving it in other investments where it could lose 20, 30, 40%. And I would hate for anybody to act on my advice because I'm definitely not all-knowing, but that's what I have advised my friends and family to do.
Okay,
keep it safe for now. And eventually, we all are going to pay for it all through massive inflation, but I just don't see that in the next year or so.
Well, let's follow that through. I'm losing my voice again. Excuse me. Let's follow that through just for a moment. Let's assume I take all my money and put it in treasuries. Government keeps on issuing trillions of extra dollars, Federal Reserve notes. Now my $1,000 worth of treasuries is only worth proportionally less. How is it putting it in treasuries? How does that help me at all? That's like putting it in stock and watching it go down, is it not?
If you're at a fixed return and inflation skyrockets,
yeah,
that's exactly it. You're getting the opposite effect then.
Right, now,
your purchasing power is going to go down.
Right. There are those people who are advocating putting your money in some sort of commodity that would adjust to inflation, whether it be gold, copper, silver, or whatever the case may be, so that in the event that we do experience exponential type of inflation, and I don't want to say hyperinflation because then we think of the Weimar Republic, you know, with the or Zimbabwe, you know, with 11 million percent inflation a year.
Yeah, but you're talking about late '70s, early '80s inflation. Of 15,
absolutely,
15,
yeah. I mean, what's to prevent gold from going to the same price, inflation adjusted, that it was in 1981, which would be somewhere in the neighborhood, and I'm just a round figure, around $2,500 an ounce or more, if it just matched the $850 price of 1981. I mean, wouldn't that be at least a hedge, a good bet? You can't lose much, I guess.
If you were sure that it was, I mean, if you're sure it was going to be it was going to retain its value, That's okay, but I mean everything, gold and silver and everything, has its own supply and demand curve, and it's just hard to say what is the baseline of that value. And you know, more gold is being poured out of the ground. Governments hoard gold and governments release gold. There are a lot of people that advocate gold. I wouldn't say yes or no to that one. I think it's probably a good idea to have some amount in precious metals. I wouldn't say everything. I wouldn't say nothing.
If we eliminated gold and silver and we eliminated treasuries, where else, what other venues do we have to park our assets?
Wow, you're asking the hard questions.
I'm sorry.
And you're seeing, a lot of people have seen that, and you've seen what's happened if you follow the markets, you know, how the money's flowed everywhere. It went from the stock market. Then it hit oil and corn and soybeans and other commodities. Those things absolutely skyrocketed. Going 300-400% from where they are now,
right,
within a matter of months. Well, people pulled out of that and parking their money somewhere else. And right now,
right,
they're parking it in treasuries, which is why you saw them dip into negative. And honestly, I have no idea. I have no idea. All I can say is that, you know, the little money I have, I'm keeping in insured bank accounts right now, and
okay,
I'm just watching. I don't know when the time is going to be to change.
Yeah,
and I hope I know when it is.
Well, what if inflation? At what point do you think it'll trigger people to do something? Well, would be the trigger for people to do something unconventional. For example, if we're at 7% inflation, people may not do anything. 7.5, nothing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden at 9 or maybe 10% inflation, that's the panic button. And at that point, you know, people will start looking for alternatives. Thus, they will do whatever, you know, but they'll do something different. They won't put it in treasuries because they're getting 0.5%. You know, they're being bombarded with this on TV about 10% inflation, so they know they're losing money now, big time, and there's going to be a flight. And do you have a guess as to where that flight will be? Because I want to be the first one there.
Well, at that time, obviously the flight's going to be into anything that is not cash. It's going to be into any asset. And so what I think you need to look at is the valuations of the assets at that time. So, I mean, you'll look at that. You've got real estate, you've got commodities, you've got the stock market, or you have other hard assets. If you have hard assets you work with in your business, you know, I don't know, if you steal or whatever you use, you'll look at that. But the problem is by the time you actually see the inflation hit 11, 12, 13%, it's kind of too late. I mean, the key to investing is you have to anticipate what other people are going to anticipate. So, you know, by the time you've got those levels of inflation, things are priced in all over the place.
Right, that's true. Yeah, like people who bought in gold at $850 an ounce back in 1981 thought they were being very safe and smart, and at that point it just continued going down all the way through 1999 and actually went down to less than $250 an ounce. So they not only got hit inflation adjusted, but they got creamed in real, you know, real dollars.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you have to do with what you did. I mean, and you gave an analysis of gold, which I'm not familiar with. Is look at its historical valuation. Where is it at? You know, where is it likely to go? And look if there's a frenzy into the asset. Is everybody saying go buy this? Is everybody saying go buy gold? Go buy a house? gold never goes down in value, like houses never go down in value. I mean, you have to apply some common sense to those things, too. And you're never going to get it all right. You got to keep that in mind, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've taken some real hits. I had Rio Tinto. I didn't buy it at this price, but it was $554 a share. And recently, it went down to $70 a share. I'd say that was kind of a hit. Don't you think so?
That's a little bit of a hit, yeah.
If you ever want to see a grown man cry, I could have sent you a few pictures. But I've had several because I'm basically all in commodities because I really don't know what to do. Someone had mentioned that one reason why the stock market, the U.S. stock market, I should say, and let me reference that, is doing relatively well is because people are not enamored with putting money in treasuries because they're not getting a return. They know that inflation adjusted, it's quite a loss for them. So they're putting it in stocks because stocks at least represents ownership in hard assets. I mean, if you have stock in General Electric or Procter & Gamble, at least there's machinery, there's real stuff there that in the event of an inflationary environment would adjust somewhat to this inflation because a tube of toothpaste, instead of being, let's say, $2, will be $5 or whatever the case may be. Is there some logic to that, Jeff?
There is some logic to it. I heard Warren Buffett say it, I want to say, a couple of years ago, that, you know, how well stocks hold up to inflation compared to other assets. And, well, I mean, we've seen what's happened to his stock also in the last few months. It's all about timing. It's all about valuations. The stock market, the main valuation people are using are price earnings or discounted future cash flows, meaning you're pricing in, how well the company is going to do in the future down to a value today. And all I would say is take all of that with a grain of salt, and that we're not in an expanding economy today. And it's likely we won't be in one for quite some time.
Yeah, so it's something that people should consider at least, right? I mean, at least consider it as
an absolutely. Alternative. And there's definitely a time and a price for it. I mean, every asset. Unless you think Armageddon's going to hit and our government collapses and it's Mad Max, then yeah, those companies will, if they can stay in business and generate the cash flows and profits, then they're going to have value.
Okay, I'd like to take, we're a little late on station identification. People holler at me over here. This is Joe Cristiano. I'm your host for Liberty Talk Radio, where we have as our guest Jeffrey Schlamman, who is the author of The Subprime Factor. He's calling from England, and we have open lines, folks, and no one's called in, and I am really hacked off. I'm coming after every one of my listeners, and I'm going to give them a spanking for not calling in, especially when we have someone calling in from overseas. The number is 646-652-4620, 646-652-4620. Please do call in with your comments or questions. Now, I want to play Wizard for a second. How do you think things will, I mean, if you had a guess, and you're forced to do this, because I'm forcing you to do this,
okay.
I apologize in advance. How do you think this whole thing is going to play out? What's your best guess?
I hate to be overly pessimistic. I don't want to sound too pessimistic. But
go for it. This is a place where you can be pessimistic and people will love you. I can tell you that. Ed.
Okay, well, we've definitely got some hard times coming. I mean, the economy's slowing. You're going to see, like we've talked about before, leverage was everywhere. It maximized returns. It maximized spending. It maximized the economy. Everything's going to slow down. Unemployment's going to go up as businesses lay off employees and go out of business, giving less spending. It's a cycle, and I think that stocks, equities have quite a ways to go down from here over the next few years. I think real estate has quite a ways to go down from here, and I think commodities have quite a ways to go down from here, which is why cash is it. Cash is going to become more valuable in terms of spending power over the next few years.
I see.
Because there's so much less of it that's going to be out there. Government, we've already seen them trying to stimulate the economy with trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. Well, there comes a point where things turn around. These dollars are still out there, and that's when the inflation hits. The problem with the inflation coming in strong is you can't have too high of inflation unless wages are getting inflated.
Right.
If that's not happening, then we're going to have an extended, long, prolonged kind of bottom to this thing. And I don't know, Joe, if you followed the recession Japan had after its big boom.
No, I'm familiar with it, but I'm not a student of that, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, but basically what happened is they just, their federal bank or their central bank brought interest rates close to zero. The economy kind of, ticked along, but it's really never grown. They've been kind of just bouncing in and out of from, almost very slight positive growth back to negative growth in their economy. Their stock market's still just a fraction of what it was two decades ago. Their housing and real estate prices are just, small fractions of what they were at the time also. And they still haven't come back. It's just been a long, decades-long recovery, which, and I think we will probably be in for something similar. Which means that we go back to a little bit different standard of living than we've had for the last 10 or 15,
you
20
mean
years.
People have to start living like I live?
Yeah, it's going to turn out that everybody that, every used car salesman can't afford a brand new 5,000 square foot house.
What if I told you I own a Subaru Impreza Outback 1996, I think it is. I can't even remember the year. And last I checked, it had 237,000 miles. Everyone in my family, except my wife uses it all the time. I ride motorcycles. When are you getting rid of that car? I said, it runs perfectly. We love the car. Stop talking about it. But, I've always been of the persuasion that given a lifestyle, everything I own would be in my would be on my backpack, and I would be more than happy to sleep in a tent on somebody else's property. Now, saying that, you would think I'm destitute, but I got a lot more money than brains, So it's kind of interesting. I'm a dichotomy, and I drive people nuts. They go, why do you do that? And I could never. I guess it's the way I was brought up. You can give me $40 million. I wouldn't change the way I live. But yet, the mentality of people today, if you give them a dollar, they'll spend 10. You give me $10, I'll try to invest 11 somehow. I've always done that. Now, in Japan, help me out with this. In Japan was the wages had not increased in Japan during their hard times in the past 20 years. Is that true? Not appreciably. They did not go through an inflationary period. Am I true? Is that right?
Yeah, my understanding is they've not had big gains there.
Yeah, I think you're onto something, because we may experience that here, because we're going through a commodities deflation right now, but with all the money being pumped in, isn't it likely that we're going to experience some sort of increased inflation just because inflation is inflating the money supply? Eventually that's a natural occurrence from that. Is that true?
It is. It is. At some point it's going to happen, but right now we're seeing it, more money or more spending power or credit, however you want to look at it, is definitely being destroyed than is being created. But yeah, at some point.
I remember in the 1970s, I'm much older than you. I'm 65 years old, by the way. I still play drums and ride motorcycles, but that's another story. I digress. I'm 15 years old at heart. I never changed. I think my mind snapped at 15 and I stayed there. But in the 1970s, I recall receiving pay increases every few months because inflation was so out of hand, and they kept on adjusting my pay. And I said this, everyone thought it was great. I said, this is not good, folks. I said, this is bad. And I said, we shouldn't be doing this, and everyone thought it was so great. But what you're saying is that we will not go through a 1970s type of inflation. We'll have inflation, but there won't be those proportional increases in pay. Pay will stay basically the same. This will lower the standard of living of the average American then.
I think that is one very possible scenario, yeah.
That, you know, that sort of makes sense, Jeff. That makes a hell of a lot of sense. And because we're going through deflation now, I can't see people getting large paychecks and whatever, you know. Anyway, by the way, you know, we only have 4 minutes remaining to the end of this broadcast. I would like to give this 4 minutes to you, Jeff, and to talk about your book a little bit more, how they can find out about it, talk about your publicist. Why don't you just, I'll give you this, that 4 minutes. I got to give you only three because I need 1 minute to sign off. So in the next 3 minutes, it's all yours.
Okay, well, yeah, I hope we didn't bore those of you that aren't interested in the financial topics. Like I said, the book is a novel. It is fiction. It is a financial thriller. It's a little bit of a conspiracy theory that turned out not to be so much of a conspiracy in the today's climate. But it's a book with all hope, you know, suspense and mystery and lots of economic and financial lessons. You can find out more about it at subprimefactor.com and also watch the video trailer for the book. That's really all I have to say about it, Joe. I hope people buy it and read it, and I thank you very, very much for having me on your show.
Well, Jeffrey, it's a real honor to have you on the show. We thank you so much for calling in, especially from good old England. Too bad we don't have a toll-free number for this. That's the only thing I feel very guilty about, but I don't make the rules around here. We enjoyed the interview. I'm sure I will be getting emails, and I will be answering those emails. Now, in the event that I need your help, do you have an email address that you can state? I guess I can go to your website and get the email address if I need to contact you. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes, you can do that.
Okay, very good.
SubprimeFactor.com.
Okay, Jeff, well, thank you very much for calling in. I truly enjoyed it, and good luck to you. And I hope we boost you to the top of the New York Times bestseller list.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Joe.
Good morning, man. Oh, wait. By the way, right now it is it's 1:30 or 1:25, right, in England? Oh, he's off the air. Okay. Well, that's right. Well, he's in England. So let's see. What time is it now? I have my international clock here. And the international clock says it's 1:27. Wow, that was an interesting interview. It was awfully nice for him to call in. I'm really disappointed, though, that no one called in. Here we go. This is the end of this morning's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free, liberated, your life is in your own hands, but with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. You now have a controlled ride that isn't any more fun. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal, the government hates competition." With that, until next time, this is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well, stay tuned.